The pandemic has thrust the public sector into the spotlight. Suddenly, health departments have been at the centre of everything, but so too have Treasury and other departments responsible for rejigging the economy and the employment landscape, and bringing people home from overseas, and managing borders, both state and national. The list goes on. So which public sector strengths and weaknesses have been exposed or highlighted by this intense flurry of activity? Which long-term trends are more apparent now than ever? Today we start a four-part series on this theme, and to kick us off, I'm delighted to welcome Verona Burgess, a veteran public sector observer. For 12 years, Verona was the Financial Review's government business editor and a must-read, in my view. She's now a columnist with The Mandarin, a news website about the public sector. And Travis McLeod is the CEO of the Centre for Policy Development. It's an independent institute which develops long-term policies for sustainable prosperity. Hello and welcome to you both.
Hello, Geraldine.
Hi, Geraldine.
Look, how would you both say the perception of the public sector has been affected by the pandemic? Let's start there, Verona.
Well, I think that it must have improved. I mean, we won't know unless there's a citizen survey that shows it. But I would say that everybody has now seen stripped bare that when there's a massive crisis of this sort, it's the public service that delivers.
Had that been waning in years before that? Like, how would you compare and contrast that sense of prestige, I suppose?
I think whenever there's a massive crisis that comes to the fore, but this has been a sustained, domestically, it's been a sustained crisis rather than a short, sharp, you know, bushfires or floods or whatever.
And do we know how people within feel about it? I was thinking of the, there's quite a lot of measuring or attempts to measure this, isn't there?
There are, and the APS employment census for 2020 has just come out this week, and it's showing some interesting things. Overall, there's a very slight improvement in what they call employee engagement, which is often used as a de facto measure of productivity. But in the departments which were deeply involved in the pandemic response, there is quite a jump. For instance, health engagement from 72% up to 75%, Prime Minister and Cabinet from 72% to 79%, Tax Office, which delivered, of course, the JobKeeper, from 72% to 76%. So I think the sense within the public service of doing important national work jumps at this kind of time.
Yes, I think from the Mandarin this week, 92% of staff said they were happy to go the extra mile at work when required. I might add, only 57% said their agency inspired them to do their best work every day. And there was a significant 36% felt burnt out by their work. Travis, does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't. Both their belief in the value of what they're doing, but also the burnout. I think Verona's right. The reputation of the public service has lifted in the eyes of all Australians. I think not just through the coronavirus pandemic, but the twin crises, the bushfires and then COVID, they've sharpened Australian attitudes about our democracy and faith in government. And we've seen parts of the public service at their best, especially those on the front line. We've depended on them literally every minute of every day, and the trust levels have climbed. So Verona mentioned some of the engagement surveys. If we look at the essential report over the last few years, trust in the Commonwealth Public Service has climbed from 42% in March 2019 to 57% in March of this year. It's even higher for health authorities, border security agencies and state and territory governments.
And you did some follow-up research of your own on this, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. So, I mean, obviously it hasn't been all smooth sailing. The vaccine rollout is the latest example. But we've done attitudes research on what Australians think about service delivery for a number of years and how much they want government involved in that. And some fascinating results from last year. So 9 in 10 Australians now think it's important for government to maintain the capability and skills to deliver services directly rather than simply paying others to do it. That's up from 3 in 4 a few years ago. And the view was emphatic regardless of voting intention, although coalition voters were more in favour. So more than ever,
Australians
So Australians expect government to be capable of playing an active role, not just in crisis management, but in service delivery. And so their democracy can improve the lives of others, particularly the most vulnerable in times like these.
But you wrote in March last year for Inside Story, Travis, that it's a small miracle we got through this at all. In fact, despite all this, our government was not prepared.
I did. And I think watching the Australian Public Service across the country respond to COVID-19 was a bit like watching a footy team starved of first-round draft picks for a decade and using software written for amateur leagues buck the odds and make the finals. There was good management, but we were very lucky. And at the end of 2019, Australia was ranked fourth globally for pandemic preparedness by Johns Hopkins University, but we scored zero in the rapid response category. So we had a script, but we hadn't been practicing. Our last national exercise on pandemics was in 2008. The medical stockpile had been run down because of cost cutting and efficiency dividends. We knew the Parliament had been told in 2013 that the novel coronavirus was very scary. So we've done well despite some underlying weaknesses across the public service, which are likely to be further exposed by the next crisis, whether it's another pandemic, cyber war, water shortage, or climate change.
Yes. Go on, Verona. You could say something.
Oh, yes, I would agree with that. I would agree that we were lucky, but I think that also probably it's sensible to recognise that the public service still has maintained a capacity to what you might call surge. Mm. You know, we saw this in the response to things like the Bali bombings, the 9/11, you know, all the sorts of crises that have come. Public service does seem to still have the ability to take a deep breath and do it, providing it's not undermined politically by bad government decisions.
I think Verona's right in that, I mean, we should be very proud of the public service in their response, but I think it shows that we've been pretty good at reacting to crises, but not particularly good at anticipating them and getting ahead of them. And you've only got to look at the glacial pace of the vaccine rollout to understand that. I mean, let's not forget it was only a few months before the pandemic struck, right at the time this global report on pandemic preparedness was released, that we had David Thodey's review into the future of the Australian Public Service, which had its own warning bells about capability of our public service across the board.
Mm. I mean, I don't want to overdwell on this, but there does seem, I think listeners will be really interested in what sort of the magic that occurred behind the surge that suggests, either of you, Verona or Travis, that there is a residue of both skill and absolute commitment and rising above yourself when there's a perceived national interest at stake, which there certainly was. I mean, I take a great deal of comfort from that, Verona.
Yes, I do too, and I think that people do. I think, of course, there are deficits and there are issues and there are problems, but I think that people join the public service. You know, if you talk to these sort of shining, bright-eyed young graduates as they come in, they all say they want to make a difference, you know, and it sounds ideologically and, you know, a bit naive because a lot of public servants never will make a difference. But that's their driving thing. That's why, you know, with a law degree and, you know, a double master's degree in foreign something or others, they go into the public service rather than work 90 hours a week in a commercial law firm because they believe somehow in the greater good. And that, I think, propels them when time of trouble because it says, this is what I'm here for.
Yes, this is my purpose. I mean, Travis, what we did see, though, would you agree, is political deference. That was what was so interesting to public servant expertise.
Exactly. And I spent a few years in the UK and I've been back since 2013. It's probably the first time since I've come home that has been the case, especially in those early stages. Late March, April last year, we saw a deference to independent expert advice, a willingness to consider really bold reforms. I mean, we took Australians out of poverty overnight. We saved industries from collapse. We conceded certain services like early learning were essential. We lifted wage subsidies. We organised surge workforces. And, I mean, probably for the first time as well, traditional combatants were prepared to, you know, come out of the trenches and work together. And we saw this across governments, across sectors. And I think it made all Australians proud that we were putting the public interest first, and particularly putting our most vulnerable Australians first.
Yes, it was interesting that there was no support for people at universities. That was an interesting... Now, that was a political decision, wasn't it, Verona?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think that we also need to remember the context, which was the absolute failure of political leadership with the bushfires. Well, I'm talking about the Prime Minister personally, and I think he must have got a terrible shock and realised when the pandemic came along, for the first time, perhaps, in his political career, he had to accept professional expertise.
I mean, I read that the Stephen Kennedy, the head of Treasury, who's obviously played an absolutely pivotal role, he was a nurse originally, apparently.
That's correct. That's correct. And I think that while I think that any head of Treasury in the past would have swung into action, I mean, that happened with the global financial crisis and so on and so forth, I think that it's had a particular kind of resonance that he started in the public health system, because it shows he does have an absolute understanding of the practicality that's required, and that economics isn't some kind of theoretical construct.
Mm. I mean, there have been, always have been, concerns about politicisation of the public service. But Verona, you think really out of this, the ultimate test has been the extent to which government was willing to take advice that normally wouldn't appeal to them.
Yes, I wouldn't quite put it like that. I think that politicians will do what they have to do. What I would say, though, was that while there are concerns, and I certainly have some concerns about levels of political interference in the public service, and you can see it in the grants programs and all sorts of things, I think that it showed that when push came to shove, the public service is more than prepared to advocate, or not in a political way, but to advise, devise and advise on policies that are diametrically opposed to the ideology of the government of the day.
Mm, maybe you need,
because the government of the day has been so committed to small government, and this required a big government response.
Mm. Travis, I've seen reports of the workforce under immense pressure, though, delivering all of this. So the programs that they have delivered, which we've noted, is it by the skin of their teeth to an extent? Is it, you know, done by, as often say, sort of lackey bands and glue, or not?
Oh, I think lackey bands and glue. I mean, I think over the decade to 2020, there's about Brian will know these figures, but I think there's about a 13% decrease in ongoing Australian public service employees, and, you know, a much bigger increase in non-ongoing employees, so consultants, contractors. There's been almost a 10% decrease in total employees. And the annual spend on consultants is just, you know, ratcheting up. It's nearly tripled across the decade to 2018-19 to around $1.2 billion a year. And, you know, I remember we went to Canberra, I think it was late January last year, you know, right towards the end of the bushfires, and there had just been the hailstorms. And the senior public servant we met with, their windows had been blown out, sheer exhaustion. And it's been a Herculean effort in the way that they've been able to respond, having, you know, let's face it, really been gutted in terms of staff numbers, while that smaller, more rational government agenda has been ascendant. And I think, you know, it's not really about politicisation. I think the bigger issue is the ideas that have driven policy discussions and have been driving them over the past decade. Martin Parkinson's been speaking about this lost decade. And the real question is whether the new normal will be sustained, this deference to expertise, willingness to consider bold reforms, or whether we'll retreat back into that very narrow agenda.
This question of expertise or loss of it's been considered, isn't it, by the Senate inquiry into the current capability of the Australian Public Service, and that's going to report later this year. Why, in your view, does it matter to have expertise in-house? Why can't it be bought in when required?
Well, let's just take one example. So let's take employment services, right, which, you know, huge government program, but delivered entirely outside of government, the National Employment Services System, JobActive. It's an entirely outsourced service system. It costs about $1.2 billion a year. Before COVID, a national review was extremely critical of the system. It found that JobActive, as it's called, had to do much better. It was designed for a pre-digital age. It had caseloads of nearly 150 job seekers per case manager, waiting periods of 2 to 5 years, and only 4% of employers were using the system. Now, the caseload of that system before COVID was 610,000. There are now 1.2 million, well over 1.2 million Australians on that caseload, and JobKeeper's just ended. And the biggest mountain we now need to climb out of COVID is the jobs one, but we have no contemporary experience or delivery capability for employment services within the Australian Public Service.
Look, just before we go, I want to ask you, Verona, probably for the final word. Transparency remains an issue, probably made worse during the pandemic. And can I make it a double header? Is there a capacity to learn from overseas? How do we compare and contrast with our overseas cousins in this respect?
I'm not very well qualified to answer that, but you probably need to look to Canada and New Zealand. And New Zealand, I think, does a lot better than we do. For a start, they publish cabinet submissions. But I think that in Australia, freedom of information has become freedom from information by and large. To push a case through has to go through the courts. It's laughable, the amount of redactions that you get back on FOI requests. The excuses that the government departments use, that it's too much work to process the request or whatever, are just kind of almost contemptible. And I think that unless you've got a minister, such as when Senator John Faulkner was the Special Minister of State, and he really made a big push to make sure that freedom of information, whistleblowing, all of this sort of stuff came to the fore, that the public service ought to have a presumption in favour of disclosure. Unless you've got that driven, public service will retreat into secrecy, and I think it's very dangerous.
And Travis, I know you think one of the capability gaps is in our foreign service in terms of our knowledge of the external world, which is becoming so complicated. Can you see that being rectified?
Well, it needs to be. I mean, this needs to be a decade-long effort, capability across the board. But, I mean, we've been looking mainly at domestic policy, but we really worry about the loss of talent and capability gaps in the Foreign Service. We do quite a bit of work in Southeast Asia on forced migration. And it's not just about the numbers of staff, but our willingness to understand the region and work with them. And, you know, I was surprised, for example, that last year the federal government decided not to continue with a review into soft power that had been committed to in the most recent foreign policy white paper, and there have been over 130 submissions received. If you think that if there's ever a time to understand how to make the most of your capability in the region, it's now.
Mm. Look, thank you both very much indeed for kicking us off today. I think that was a very good sort of broad overview. Verona Burgess and Travis McLeod.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Verona Burgess, a columnist with the Mandarin News website, and Travis McLeod, who's CEO of the Centre for Policy Development